You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Hello, you're listening to Kill Your Lawn and Kick Your Fence, and today we are broadcasting today from the stolen lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. Sovereignty was never ceded, and their ancient and enduring societies are a blueprint of living for the rest of us. So-called Australia is a crime scene and the genocide is still happening. First Nations listeners, be advised today that we may be mentioning names of people that have passed. Welcome. It's just gone 2 minutes past 9 o'clock in the morning. And today we're going to get straight into a conversation with special guest today, Kieran. Hey, Kieran.
How you going?
Yeah, so Kieran Stewart Ashington from Yellerman, the Black People's Union, and I saw in the Rahu elections, because I'm an inactive member. I saw that you're actually involved in Rahu as well, and in your little thing, you've also helped Lydia Thorpe with policy. So you're like all over the place.
Yeah. I've been involved in heaps of different orgs and. Heaps of different organising spaces. At the moment, I'm the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander officer for Rahu. But I've worked before with Lydia. I've worked with, the Black Sovereign Movement. Worked with a lot of different orgs up in New South Wales as well, where my mob come from. So like the New South Wales Aboriginal Land Rights Association, for example, and a bunch of other little orgs and collectives and stuff just around Southeast Australia.
Yeah, and I think, I don't think we need to have people want qualifications. They want, what's your credentials before you criticize something I say kind of thing. I tuned in to 3CR one afternoon, and you were talking to on Radical Australia. You say you've been organizing for 15 years. We're really lucky to have you here, Kieran, at 3CR. Today, the plan for today's episode is to talk about Eurocentrism in, quote-unquote, progressive politics, and then to move that into talking about, our gardens and how we approach, the green spaces, and maybe trying to decolonize our approach to how we try to re-green these spaces that live in. Yeah. So I thought we might start. Oh, and we'll be joined later by a group sort of doing this in an interesting way, a pirate nursery called Basalt Buddies. And I'm curious to see what the pirate part is. Like, are they stealing from Bunnings or something? So let's start with Marxism. I was listening. So someone I've seen you collaborate online with is Decolonize Buffalo.
Yeah.
So I started listening to some of their podcasts, and they made a point, which I think I've noticed in the more dogmatic socialist groups, that sort of like Trotsky type groups, like Socialist Alternative and stuff, where the history of the world, they stick to that early Marx idea, which is not sort of changed towards later in his work, but that early Marx idea that we were like barbarian, primitive societies, then slaves, and then feudal societies, and then capitalist. And that just doesn't, for me, that just doesn't, so we're going to start there talking about that. That just doesn't reflect world history. Yeah. And it doesn't count what the legacy of the Roman Empire and how the church was spread, and the foundation of the United Kingdom was also a religious project. So it's not fully, but it also misrepresents so-called barbarian primitive societies, because Marx is actually taking a lot of with collectivism, and also when we talk about collectivism, it was already being done.
Exactly. there's a lot to really talk about there, and a lot to touch on. But I think, first and foremost, I disagree with that whole notion about, the so-called evolution of society that Marx and Lenin as well talks about it as well, that they put forward with all these different steps. Because, why it might be the case, in Europe and, you know, maybe in other places around the world. Like, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that their idea is completely 100% wrong and never applied anywhere. You know, it probably did apply in certain parts of Europe. But what it does, it completely ignores the structure of indigenous societies right across the world. You know, let's just talk about right here, for example, in so-called Australia. You know, before colonization, we weren't a bunch of, you know, primitive hunter-gatherers and, you know, barbarians and whatever else. We actually had quite complex societies and systems in place, especially in terms of agriculture and industry. We had massive food industries right across this continent. We had, you know, all of this excess surplus of food that we would create as a part of our big farming projects. And we never had to rely on stuff like slavery or exploiting each other's labor, or any of these other, you know, these other steps that Marx and Lenin talk about being crucial steps in the development of modern societies. So, you know, right there, like that there is, you know, perfect sort of proof in the pudding that, you know, these steps aren't necessarily ones that a society must take, because we've been here 100,000 years or more. You know, we never had slaves in that time. There's no history of slavery on this continent until the English come in and enslaved us after 1788.
Yep.
But prior to that, we didn't have slavery. We didn't have, you know, capitalist classes, and we didn't have a structured society where the means of production and all of the surplus value was held by one or two individuals. It was all held communally. So yeah, you know, I think that just really like debunks, I suppose, the, what's the word I'm looking for? The universality of Marx's claims.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, so one of the things that's going to come up in this show is this concept by André Lefebvre called The Right to the City. And I think about this in the context of some of the Decolonized Buffalo stuff I've started listening to, where the for some Marxists, I'm not saying all, I mean, some of the people on that podcast identify as Marxist-Leninists. So, like, it's a whole, like, this isn't like we hate Marxism, we hate communism. Yeah, 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 yeah. Just being, like, clear for people, because I think people get, they hear a bit of criticism and they switch off.
Yeah. Well, you know, just on that note, sorry if you're about to say something.
No, yeah.
But just on that note, you know, that's the thing, like, quite a lot of decolonial theorists do come from that, you know, Marxist-Leninist tradition, but we didn't stop there. You know, the problem with so many of these dogmatic Marxists and, you know, these patriotic socialists, as we call them, you know, these colonial chauvinist kind of socialists, is that they focus on Marx and Lenin's traditions and teachings, but then they stop there. And, you know, there's 150 plus years of theory that has developed since that, you know, takes into account all these other contradictions like colonization and imperialism. And, you know, we've got all of these great authors, like whether it be Mao, whether it be Ho Chi Minh, whether it be any of the, you know, number of authors that have come out of places like Africa or South America or Asia. Mm. You know, they've all contributed to Marxist theory, but all of these dogmatic European socialists ignore all their all their teachings.
Yeah, and, you know, like in the US, like it's such a, it's, it should be at least, like a really important talking point about, like, people like Malcolm X and the Black Panther Party. Yeah. And that existed here too. So, like, that's always existed here too. And Dennis J. Walker, you know, son of Ujiru Nunukul, they recently made a documentary about her on SBS, which was really awesome. I wish I learned about her in school. Never did. Yeah. But they kind of did it. They kind of made him like the militant son who was rebelling against mom kind of thing. And, like, you know, that he, you know, he's a troublemaker, but, you know, that he was trying to, like, I actually think it's pretty amazing that there's a clip of him walking through because he was trying to sort of do Black Panthers here, is my understanding. I don't know enough because there's just not enough education out there. I think the only person I can get that information from is probably Uncle Robbie because he knew him.
Yeah, yeah.
But he, there's a clip of him walking through the streets and he's got a gun. And he said, if the cops can hold a gun, then why can't I defend myself? And that, I think, you know, one of the things that's central to all this is, so Marxism is like everything, capitalism creates all the isms, like it creates racism, it creates sexism, it creates that. I disagree with that. I think it throws some of those things into hyperdrive, but those things existed before capitalism.
Yeah, definitely.
And that, and it, yes, it does exploit division. Like, I'm not going to disagree. Like, yes, Dutton is doing shit to divide people. Yes, no one's like disagreeing with that. We're just talking about like and I think in Decolonized Buffalo, they're saying that it's not that everything comes from capitalism. For what they're putting forward is everything comes from colonialism.
Yeah.
And that we also, and I'm still learning the nuances between this. Us settlers don't have a good understanding of the difference between imperialism and colonialism. And I was wondering if you could talk to that.
Yeah. So the difference, look, when we start to talk about differences, we have to realize that we're talking about two overlapping structures. A lot of what we would call imperialism or colonialism is the same thing. They're just more kind of, I suppose, specific terms for when we look at the different ways that colonialism or imperialism can operate. So, you know, to give you a bit of an example, you know, Australia is an imperialist state. It's, you know, practices imperialism right across the global south. But not only that, it could be called a colonial imperialist occupation of the Aboriginal nations here. So, you know, it's, there's a whole, we have to like, to talk about this stuff will take ages.
Yeah.
But there's, you know, all these different kinds of colonialism, there's all these different kinds of imperialism, but they're not necessarily ones that can be pigeonholed off or siloed off as individual things, because there's such an overlap between all of them. And they're all systems that uphold each other and work together with each other and coexist amongst one another. So, you know, when we look at colonialism, for example, there is no such thing that is just colonialism. There is all different kinds of colonialism, whether it be settler colonialism or extraction colonialism or plantation colonialism or, you know, et cetera, et cetera. There's probably a dozen or more different kinds.
Parliamentary democracy colonialism.
Yeah. You know, we've got, you know, a dozen or more different kinds of colonialism and imperialism. But for the most part, like, they are very overlapping, coexisting structures and systems. And it all comes down to that domination of land, resources, and people. At the end of the day, you know, that's, I suppose that is how you could summarize colonialism and imperialism. They're systems of dominating a people and dominating a land so that you can extract the natural resources and you can control, you know, the land itself and the means of production and the people, et cetera, et cetera.
And so when there's like a social revolution or some kind, and somehow enough people identify as, say, as socialists, right? But it's still largely a settler-led movement. And that's why I was sort of referring to the right to the city, because there's a lot of stuff in Marx where it's like, it's not the capitalists' land. This is our land and we're going to take it back.
Yeah,
that's also could very well be re-perpetuating colonial mindsets and actions if you're not talking land back and if you're not in coalition with First Nations people.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, this is what we often talk about as First Nations revolutionaries as well, about, you know, settler-led socialist projects and settler-led revolutionary projects are ultimately, at the end of the day, just a continuation of the settler project and, you know, the colonial project itself. If we don't have control over our land and our resources, we're not liberated at the end of the day. You know, that's what all liberation, peace and freedom stems from. It stems from control over your land and your resources. You know, people like Malcolm X and whoever else have, you know, all said the same sort of things in their speeches and theories. But we've got, you know, all of these issues, I suppose, coming up with these settler-led revolutionary movements, because for the most part, and this is the thing that people don't understand, you know, yes, they might address some things like capitalism, and, you know, yes, they might address the exploitation of the general working class, but it doesn't address all of these other issues that stem directly from colonization itself. You know, it wouldn't address, for example, the massive ecocide we see here and the climate collapse and all of these other issues tied to Eurocentric models of farming and managing the land. Because, you know, just because a bunch of settlers, you know, liberate themselves from capitalism, how does that magically endow them with the knowledge to be able to manage the land properly? Mm. And, you know, all of these are new agricultural techniques that are actually compatible with the soils here, as opposed to the Eurocentric ones that aren't. You know, so there's all these other issues. And racism, you know, like the exploitation, the oppression, and the, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? The disenfranchisement of First Nations people, you know, that won't be addressed by a settler-led revolution. You know, Australia is a very racist country.
Yeah.
We know this statistically as well. There's been, you know, lots of different studies and whatever else that have, you know, determined that, and with thousands of people too, mind you, like studies of thousands of people, but have determined essentially something like 75% of Australians are racist. And this isn't, you know, 75% of right-wingers or whatever. It's 75% across the board, regardless of their education, their gender, their religion, their political beliefs, any of that sort of stuff. 75% are anti-Indigenous.
Yeah.
And we see that. again, playing out in these left-wing movements and these socialist movements. And so many of them still hold on to these anti-Indigenous sentiments and this anti-Aboriginal propaganda that they're very much raised with in this colony. So, you know, when we're talking about settler-led revolutions, it's not going to address any of that racism that exists or that discrimination that exists against us.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, too, you know, it's at the end of the day, you know, we have to look at it from a logical point of view and a ethical point of view. And how is it not a continuation of the settler-led project? Oh, sorry, of the colonial project, when you have settlers still managing the land and still dispossessing First Nations people of our land and resources.
Yeah, well, you were on Uncle Robbie's show earlier in the week and he was talking about customary law, right?
Yeah.
Like how ignorantly and also with a colonial mindset have we, and I say we as in white settlers and my ancestors, fucked up this land. And like, you know, the kill your lawn thing isn't so much to jump onto that movement of you as an individual plant some nice flowers in your lawn. It's actually, no, lawns go right back to a particular moment in history. And they're literally a physical representation of some, of this oppressive colonial social order.
Yeah, yeah.
And how, like, lawns and hedges and fences and houses. I mean, yes, it's capitalist, but it's also about this domination over nature. It's about, you know, bringing that European aesthetic to here. Like in Israel, right? Uncle Robbie says, you know, Australia's just one big West Bank. And we talk about how horrible it is that Israel's planting gum trees and pines that don't belong in Palestine. Well, what about here? We're living past like that point. Like what we're seeing in Palestine, we're living further down the line.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, that is a really big thing too, the whole, and people don't see it this way, but ultimately all of those foreign plants and those foreign trees that are planted and whatnot, they're monuments to colonization at the end of the day. And, you know, monuments to European heritage and European culture.
Plane trees. Everyone hates them, but they're to look like the English streets.
Yeah. And how is that not, you know, a monument to Europe and to England and to colonization when you want to change a whole entire landscape? And this is something that colonizers do everywhere in the world. They've done it everywhere they've gone. You know, you look at the environmental destruction across the Americas, across Asia, and like, you know, as you just said, like in Palestine now, the environmental destruction that's happening there as a result of, you know, people coming in and chopping down all the native fauna and native flora, and, you know, killing all the native fauna and replacing it with their own.
Yeah. I think you talked about racism, and I think, you know, if you feel, when I started listening to 3CR in 2020, I moved down from Sydney to Melbourne. And I started listening. I just tuned in different radio stations, found 3CR. I was like, whoa, what the hell? And I started listening to Uncle Robbie. And at first, I was very challenged and confronted. But I kept listening. And over time, like, you know, I started to understand things. And I think if you listen to people and you feel confronted and you feel like a hostile reaction, rather than being reactive, like, think about it. Go away and reflect.
Yeah.
And you know, particularly, I mean, if you're young at university and you waking up to the shit show that is the world, it can be really helpful. It can feel really empowering when you're given a doctrine or a dogma to really, like, help you be like, this is what's wrong and I'm going to follow this. And it's really invigorating. But the world's just more complicated than that.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So let's... keep going forever, but I'm going to play some CSAs and we're going to talk a bit about liberalism, then we'll get onto the gardening because it's all going to tie in together.
Sounds good.
I'm from the Lakota Nation in the geographical center of North America that we call Turtle Island, and community radio is about your community, your heart, which 3CR Community Radio is right here at 85.5 AM. So it is digital, and I'm presuming you can go worldwide with it. People are listening in America to you, so talk back, Australia, to the earth. Peace with earth. Thank you. Teokas and Ghost Horse. Community Radio is your love.
And I don't believe in fighting today in any one front, but on all fronts. In fact, I'm a black nationalist freedom fighter.
This country is a nation of thieves.
Now, we're never going to get justice here in these filthy racist courts here.
Our people have been massacred, and we're not supposed to grieve for that. We've got to do something more drastic if we're serious about this.
Move over or we going to move on over you.
Yellerman with Kieran Stewart-Asherton on 3CR. Dives deep into Indigenous resistance and global anti-colonial struggles. Featuring frontline activists, it confronts Australia's identity, challenges power structures, and fuels revolutionary discourse. Wednesdays, 12 to 1pm.
And you're listening to Kill Your Lawn and Kick Your Fence on 3CR Community Radio. And we're here with Kieran Stewart-Asherton. And we're talking about sort of Eurocentrism and decolonizing in this space. So we've just talked a bunch about Marxism, but we could keep going. And I think also, so if you want to, you know, reflect and learn more, you have a library, right?
Yeah.
I guess I started with Angela Davis when I started learning about this stuff. But do you have any authors off the top of your head that you think would be good for people to read?
Yeah, there's a few. I would recommend that people read Robert Beale, in particular, one of his books, Eurocentrisms. I can't remember exactly what it's titled, but it's like the Eurocentricity of Marxism or something like that.
And that podcast I was saying, they just did an interview. They've got an interview with him as
But yeah, that's a good one to, you know, look at how Eurocentricity leaks into Marxism and into our movements. There's a whole bunch of different authors from places like North America. When I say this, I'm talking obviously about the First Nations authors. There's also a whole bunch of different authors that have come out of places like Africa that really dissect colonialism and imperialism. Walter Rodney is another good one. Walter Rodney really explores the impact of European imperialism and colonization and exploitation across Africa. Kwame Nkrumah is, of course, another good one. A lot of great revolutionary theory, again, tied into that whole colonial and imperialist angle. And, of course, can't forget about Frantz Fanon. You know, definitely another great author that's really contributed a lot to that decolonial theory.
So we're going to move on to liberalism. And listeners may remember that I sort of gave a criticism of liberalism where I was talking about how I read an introductory book into it, and I read On Liberty by John Stuart Mill, and I read part of The Social Contract. It was fucking rough. I couldn't keep reading that one. And basically what I was saying, and I'm not new to this critique, this is like a postmodern critique, is that liberalism from the beginning hasn't had an accurate idea of what truth and power are. So for example, here, truth telling about what actually happened, liberals ignore it. And these ideas, you know, John Stuart Mill literally writes about the uncivilized and barbarians, and that they are deserving of despotism. So there's this superiority white supremacist built into liberalism, which I think a lot of liberals find offensive.
Yeah.
But I actually think it's hard to ignore that it's there in its history and in its foundations. What do you think about that?
No, yeah, it definitely is. And that's, again, like, you know, a lot of liberals ignore this. But liberalism is the ideology that actually justifies stuff like slavery, that justifies colonization itself. When we look at the colonization of this continent and the Americas, it was all justified by liberal thought. So, you know, liberalism is something that, you know, hides behind this mask of being progressive. But at the end of the day, it's anything but. It's actually quite a regressive, quite a harmful and dangerous ideology that, you know, not only underpins all these justifications, as I was just saying, for stuff like slavery and colonization, but it's actually what underpins essentially everything wrong in our society now. You know, liberalism is an ideology that focuses on the individual and individualism. And, you know, that individual outlook is essentially the core of, you know, the vast majority of our issues in society, whether it be capitalism itself, whether it be colonialism, whether it be racism and misogyny, whether it be environmental destruction, you know, the justification of exploiting one another and oppressing one another and not serving your community, not helping your community and having that individual outlook. It's, yeah, it's a really horrible ideology. And yeah, it's, again, something that is, you know, so Eurocentric and tied into a lot of the Euro European theories that have come out over the last few hundred years. Like, you know, there's even influences of liberalism throughout Marxism, throughout Marx and Lenin's work.
They are all actually happening around the same time.
Yeah.
Even anarchism can, like, when you... There was a lot, the French Revolution is what they were all largely talking about. And you could actually see, I mean, I think a lot of anarchists are more libertarian than they are anarchists. Mm. And but that's also because they were influenced at the time, at the roots of it all, by the same sort of conversations. Yeah.
Yeah. And, John Locke's and whoever else. And
Yeah. And so the suburbs are a really good visual of that liberalism, and that's what I the episode is called, "Lawns and Liberalism's a Tale of Two Steves," and I talk about how, like, in liberalism, you've got your private space, you're in, like, it's all about the individual, it's all about your space and your right, and that's like exactly how the suburbs were designed. And I know a Marxist might say, "Well, that's capitalist design," and like, yes, there is a capitalist design, but it's just not so simple just to say it's all one thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's definitely got its roots in, you know, multiple areas.
Yeah. So I just like, and the other thing that ties into this is that liberalism, and this happens, and so we were just talking about it before the show, and I was saying that it kind of, to me, and maybe you could express it more eloquently than me, is that we have, we kind of are a segregated apartheid society in Australia. It's not said. Liberals pretend it isn't happening. Mm. They go, well, they say all the right things. The Labor Party says all the right things and then does nothing. Or in fact, as you've pointed out on your show, makes it worse.
Yeah.
And let's also not forget that the quote unquote progressive party is often the party that creates the situation for the more fascistic, the more far right party to come in the first place. Like the Democrats perfectly demonstrated that. They would rather Trump walk in than, you know.
Yeah, well, they handed him their presidency.
Yeah. Our next guest is coming in. Take a seat. We'll get chatting soon. Just enjoy the ride. So the idea that fascism hasn't arrived yet, but I always think, and this was mentioned, I was at a conference where someone was saying, you know, we haven't hit fascism yet. We haven't seen, you know, but the fascism that we'll see here won't look like the death camps of like Nazi Germany. And I just piped up then and gave a National Indigenous Time article that came out in the past week saying that there are up to 20 First Nations women's in cell in the Northern Territory in a cell with the one toilet, one sink, and the sinks above the toilet, and that's also where they get their drinking water. And also that fascism already happened here to First Nations people. There already were death camps. So I think that because us as settlers in this movement, we are not directly affected by those things, and First Nations people are removed out of sight a lot of the time by the police force, by gentrification and stuff. We actually start talking and forgetting, and we that's where a lot of these problems, I think, are happening, about what actually is happening to a whole segment here, while we're like, you know, oh, the class struggle, but also the genocide, the coloniality.
There's a lot to talk about here, but I'll try and just be super quick. But you know, Australia has always been fascist ever since the British arrived here in 1788. You know, let's look at Nazi Germany, right, for an example. Nazi Germany had concentration camps. We had concentration camps here too. We had concentration camps here for 150 years. You know, they had death camps over in Nazi Germany. We had death camps here too, where black fellows would be rounded up and they would be slaughtered. You know, you look at stuff like mass incarceration, and again, you know, the highest incarceration rates in world history right here today in Australia, First Nations people. And again, you know, you compare it to other current fascist societies, like let's look at Israel, right? And you look at the amount of Palestinians and especially Palestinian youth that are detained by Israel, yet Australia detains blackfellas at even higher rates than Israel mass detains Palestinians.
And it's illegal occupation.
Yeah.
So please release your hostages, Australia.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And, you know, there's just so much fascism that exists here. Like, you look at the way our families are ripped apart, our children are taken at a rate of, you know, one in four or more. And you look at all of the other institutionalized policies and, you know, the other structures and systems that exist that are geared towards oppressing and exploiting First Nations people. Like, how can you say this isn't a fascist society? It's, you know, it's fascist in nearly every single way. And in fact, you look at these other places like, you know, apartheid South Africa and Nazi Germany, and you look at where they got their influence and where they got their ideas from. And again, it was right here in Australia. Like South Africa's apartheid policies, for example, modeled directly off Queensland's white Australian policy. You know, you look at the concentration camps in Nazi Germany, again, modeled directly off the missions and reserves here in Australia.
Yeah, it's damning. And that's, you know, that's why it's got to be front and center, right? Of, you know, our left-wing movements. We've got to just face up to the fact that it's not as simple as, you know, just a single ideology, and that we are benefiting from this.
Yeah.
I'm 5th or 6th generation. I've had so much benefit from it, and my family has, and my family's participated in genocide, and technically I just do passively. Okay, so we're going to go to break. I might get you to play a song you forgot from your phone. Then we'll meet our next guest, and then we're going to start applying this to, you know, gardening and decolonizing that.
Sounds good.
Slums in some metropolitan centers are coming down, condemned by forward-looking civic governments. Down are coming the bad living conditions that produce bad citizens.
The practical uses of asbestos are very numerous. At least 18,000 articles are made of it.
In the spring, the nature-loving Australian goes bush. The wife washes and the dishes dry themselves.
It's a serial pest.
Cities within cities, scientifically planned and built, where a man and his family with a small income can live with comfort and dignity as investments in democracy.
Kill your lawn and kick your fence. A show about how we live in the cities and suburbs and the ideologies behind them. Fridays every fortnight at 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. on 3CR 855 AM.
From rubbish tip to you.
Good long while, and then Hangalia. Oh, good long while, Memena.
Oh, You're listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned to hear the rest of your 3CR podcast.
You're back, listeners, with Kill Your Lawn and Kick Your Fence. Before we get to our guest, Kieran, I brought a poem along today, speaking of Ujiru New Knuckle, and the poem's called Municipal Gum, and I thought Kieran could read it for us.
Gum tree in the city street, hard bitumen around your feet. Rather you should be in the cool world of leafy forest haws and wild bird caws. Here you seems to me like that poor cart horse, castrated, broken, a thing wronged, strapped and buckled, its hell prolonged, whose hung head and listless mien expression its hopelessness. Municipal gum, it is dolorous to see you thus, set in your black grass of bitumen. O fellow citizen, what have they done to us?
Yeah. Ah, oh, so great. And I'm so, like I was saying earlier, like I didn't learn about Ujiru in school, and we should have.
Yeah.
It wasn't until an SBS thing that, yeah, I'd actually learnt about her. And Uncle Robbie speaks so highly of her, and like that's another person we should read.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, definitely, yeah.
Yeah. We have Matt with us in the studio. Hey, Matt, who are you?
What's up, Long Killers? My name's Matthew. I'm here today on behalf of Basalt Buddies, which is a loose collective of friends and comrades that are trying to get involved in, I guess, revegetation and plant justice, with the goal of bringing back more of the proper plants that are meant to be growing in our gardens, the plants that were growing there pre-invasion. Whether that's because your house is built on a grassland or a floodplain, ephemeral waterway, or maybe a dry forest like eucalypt or she-oak. Trying to educate people and then get their hands on stuff, because that's what makes someone start to care about something, seeing it, touching it, learning about what it does and the complex relationships.
Yeah, and the reason I really like your project, not just because of how you're going about it, it's because you're actually challenging these like social orders that we're talking about by doing what you're doing. And the CSIRO last year released this book I've got in my hands called The New Ornamental Garden.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, CSIRO, they're governed by science, right? They would well, what they did was they just gave it to this gardener from who used to be the head of Diggers, which is a very Eurocentric style of gardening. They do, like, heirloom seeds, and that's important, but... if you go to their gardens, it's like walking into England. It's full of like poems from like English authors like Percy Bysshe Shelley and all that stuff. And he wrote a section here called The Native Myth. And he basically says that planting indigenous species is not necessary in your garden, and that it's political correctness in gardening gone mad. He uses the words political correctness. Yeah. So it's wokeness coming to gardening. But this is actually this is a widespread idea. Like, I think people think that just because people are green-thumbed or greeny that they don't think about that. I mean, it's racist, but yeah. Matt.
So the easiest argument I can come up with for that, against Mr. Science, is that in the Kulin Nations alone, we would have hundreds of thousands of species of insects.
Yeah.
And a big chunk of those have symbiotic dependencies. Mm. So the moths are a really good example. A lot of moths will only complete their life cycle on a single genus of plant, whether it's a Callistemon moth, a Senecio moth, things like that.
Yeah.
You take that plant out of the landscape, you have a localized extinction of that insect.
Yeah.
And a lot of these insects will only forage up to 400 meters.
Yeah.
So for every 400 meters that they can't access the plant they need,
yeah,
they're gone from that area until the plant comes back.
Ah, yeah, exactly. And Kieran, do you want to add to the...
By
the way, this is full of... You'll recognize all the plants in here. It's got agapanthus, it's got succulents, it's just got everything that you already see in dry gardens in Australia. Mm. But yeah.
Yeah, look, it really is a ridiculous notion. And the thing is too, like a lot of our plants are quite localized as well in their own distribution. And, you know, I hate to think of how many plant species we've actually lost over the last 200 years because, you know, they only grew in an area that was maybe a few square kilometers.
Yep.
And that was it. That was the extent of their range. And now that's a city or a farm or something, and they're just not there anymore.
Yeah.
And even ones that had larger ranges, like you look at Murnong, for example. Murnong's a really great one. It's great that they've been able to save it. Don't get me wrong. You know, it's really great work that they've been doing to preserve that species. But there was a point in time where Murnong nearly went extinct because of sheep farms. And, you know, that was a plant that covered the southeast corner of Australia, and it was nearly driven to extinction.
Yeah. Sunbury right now is basically, it's a very important like grassy plains, and also was a food production zone. And it's under Hume City Council, and it's all slated for suburbs now. And that's what's happened. Like the really bad new suburbs of no yards, astroturf, that kind of stuff. So this colonial project of, like, because one of the things they'll say, right, because I work in this industry, one of the things they'll say is they'll say, well, actually, there's going to be more trees than there was before. What they're saying, they're not saying before colonial settlement. They're saying when it was farmland, when they destroyed all the native, like, flora and fauna. And by the way, like, I've got an interview I'll be playing in the coming week with Wildlife Victoria. Farmers treat their livestock like crap.
Mm.
Like, they don't even provide them shade. Like, I feel so bad for the sheep in summer. But, yeah, like, in terms of extinction, there's probably many insects that have gone extinct that we just don't know.
For sure, yeah. And I guess to give the example of those symbiotic-dependent insects, they're particularly understudied because we're not giving much funding to that area. So the scientists are just going out and casting a big net and catching what they catch. If they never point that net at a certain plant, they don't know what insect might have been on it.
Yeah, and I've got a book there, which listeners might know if they're a garden nerd. It's called Native Plants of Melbourne or something.
Yeah, Flora of Melbourne.
Flora of Melbourne. You're probably familiar with that one, Matt. Yeah. So that one has every municipality in Melbourne and, like, plants. And it's pretty extensive and it's pretty big. But it goes to show just how much diversity. Even there's, like, Darabin, because we're working on a thing together, in hopefully in March, which is in the Darabin area.
Mm-hmm.
And Darabin's split into two things in that book.
Sure.
There's actually a lot of biodiversity within Darabin. And, like, I remember seeing a EVC, which is environmental map, of where I used to live in Coburg, and at the bottom of my street, there apparently used to be a creek that just isn't there anymore.
Yeah.
And so, like, water and food.
Yeah,
water and food systems existed within a walkable distance everywhere.
Mm.
Yeah. I've got one worse for you we're focusing on the negatives. So I live on the north side of Footscray, and I was I found an old piece of writing from, I think it's been edited more recently, but it's taken from a book written in the 1850s. And 2.5 kilometers from my place, there was a she-oak forest, and it had koalas in it. It's now the golf course and industrial estate.
Yeah.
And you got to drive, 40, 50 kilometers to see a koala now.
Yeah. And so one of the magazines I brought in today is a permaculture magazine, and it's called Pip Magazine. And it's pretty good. That's the one. Yeah. And they have this series. What I did, Kieran, to make it a bit easier, is I cut out all the pages that they do on Indigenous knowledge section. And so they've had someone who goes around, and she oak in here, it's a little tokenistic, these Indigenous knowledge sections, and, you know, it doesn't really address it's like, oh, look in your garden, you can add this thing. But I find this one a really interesting example because the she-oak was a really important plant for kids, according to Tricia Ellis, who wrote this article, who's a First Nations woman on the sort of south
My country.
Yeah.
Your own country.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you know Trish?
I don't, but I'm familiar with some of their work.
Yeah. So I don't know them either, but they're saying that maybe you can talk a bit more about this sort of thing, that in First Nations culture, the she-oak thicket was a safe place for kids to go if they were lost, is what she was saying. So if they got lost, the thicket was safe. The needles bed was really easy to start a fire with. It irritates snake skins. Mm. And also, there's a certain sound they make in the wind, so people could identify them and find them. But also the bull ones, which are like really big seeds they would give to kids when they're having nightmares to hold at night. And so when they're having a nightmare, they'd squeeze it. It would sort of help. But yeah, I'll just pass that on to you, Kieran. But I'm a little bit wary about these kinds of Indigenous knowledge sections in magazines and stuff, just because I feel like it participating in like the mining of Indigenous knowledge and stuff. But what I'm getting to is there's multiple uses for those plants, and trees can be medicine, they can be shelter, they can be kindling, like, and in terms of like surviving the oncoming apocalypse, people need to know this stuff, right? Like, I think so.
Yeah.
I mean, like, when our systems collapse, we don't have a nationalized like pharmaceutical system, so where are you gonna get your medicine from?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, I'm probably gonna have to turn into a vampire to get my hormones. No, I'm kidding. I won't. I'll just give up hormones. I have no choice. But you've talked a bit about the uses of plants and stuff. Like, this is again challenging that colonial myth that that you backwards society or anything. But yeah, like such in depth knowledge. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. So, we had heaps of knowledge here prior to colonization around different uses for plants, you know, not just food, but all different kinds of medicine, all different kinds of like tools and glue and shelter and whatever else. But we had quite a lot of medicine plants as well. Heaps of our medicine covered like most of the things that is covered today, like even cancer, for example. Yeah. And, you know, this isn't just me saying this, is some black fella. Whatever, there's actually a lot of documented evidence from this from white settlers. But my people, we had a cure for cancer prior to colonization.
Damn.
And this was still in action at least 50 years after our area had been colonized. So I'm talking into like the 1850s, 60s here. There's actually a black fella, Dr. Greenwell, he was known as. Greenwell Point's now named after him, but he knew how to make this cancer and this cancer treatment. Mm. And there's all these stories from these white settlers who were, you know, absolutely riddled with traumas, tumors.
Tumors, sorry. Yep.
As you can tell, it's still very early. I'm not fully awake yet, but absolutely riddled with tumors. And they would go and see him, and he would make this medicine from all these different plants. Unfortunately, we've lost a lot of this knowledge. The only ingredient I know of is the bracken fern. That was one of many ingredients. But, you know, they would go and make this, it looked like black tar, the way it was described, and they would drink it, and within a couple of months, all their tumours would be gone.
Yeah. Oh.
And, you know, now I'd look around the world, though, like, you know, we apparently don't have cures for cancer around the world and
our whatever
society
else. Is a cancer-causing society. Yeah.
But, you know, there's so much knowledge that has been lost, but there's also so much that still exists that is still in the process of being lost because it's not being preserved or because these plant species are going extinct and endangered.
Yeah.
And it's something where I'm of a very conflicted sort of mindset here. On the one hand, you know, I think it'll be great for everybody, you know, whether they're Indigenous or settlers, to get involved with this sort of stuff, you know, to learn about plants and their usage, to grow them in your backyard and, you know, to make sure that that culture is preserved and those plant species are preserved. But at the same time, there is a very real threat for our communities and our knowledge to be capitalized on point where it actually disenfranchises us. So, you know, one really great example is the Kakadu plum. Mm. Kakadu plum is something that's been used in food and medicine for millennia by the mob up in NT. But recently it has been co-opted by a bunch of white pharmaceutical companies and cosmetic companies. They've trademarked it and put all these copyright restrictions on it. So now mob can't even, you know, make their own Kakadu plum products and label it as Kakadu plum without being sued for copyright or infringements. And now the biggest Kakadu plums the biggest concentration of Kakadu plums in the world isn't in Australia, it's in Russia. Because they're over there growing it all for cosmetics.
And I guess this is what goes back to what we were talking about earlier about putting the resources, the means of production and stuff in First Nations hands.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely, yeah.
Yeah, and otherwise we're just going to keep stealing and mining knowledge. Like you, like Dr. Kate was talking with you about like water knowledge. Yeah. Like, we want to save ourselves, but we're also literally like just mining it out and putting it out there to, you know, continue to live the same lifestyles. Like in those magazines, the reason I brought them in is like, they're selling you things. It's about living this very liberal, individualistic lifestyle. I'm not trying to defame people or anything, but I'm just saying like magazines are a great insight into like the zeitgeist of how people live.
Yeah.
And you know, it's like, oh, well, you can be a good settler. You can do some healing and plant a tree.
Yeah.
It's like, no, there's systemic change that needs to happen.
Yeah.
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 I also wanted to ask you about a little bit about how the operation works while we still have time, Matt.
Yeah, yeah, sure. Yeah, yeah. So at the moment we've got like a 7-meter greenhouse in the backyard of my friend Billy's. And so we're growing probably anywhere between a dozen and 20 species at the moment. I can't remember exactly, but we've got a few thousand of them.
Well done.
We've done a couple of pop-up sales days, just selling them real cheap, just to basically recuperate the costs of dirt and driving around to collect secondhand pots and all that kind of stuff. But it is pretty cheap to do, and luckily we have a lot of friends who come for the hands-on stuff and end up making a big day of it and having a lot of fun and getting more and more people involved in that side of things. I guess the reason I think it's important to even get people started on the, you know, the production and giving back side is another threat to the sharing of Indigenous knowledge is that most of it's only survived in small amounts in the wild. So how can you trust someone with that knowledge? You know, if you said, oh, there's a cure for cancer, but there's only 200 of the plants left, they're going to be gone pretty quick.
Yeah, yep, absolutely.
So teaching people, hey, this stuff's really cool. Let's offset it and work with it that way and try and give back to the land.
Yeah, absolutely. It makes me think of this old show called The Bush Tucker Man a bit, which I don't know if you've ever seen The Bush Tucker Man, Kieran. No. The old uncles at the uncles, I don't know, being weird, the uncles at Camp Sovereignty knew it very well. It's basically Major Les Hiddens from after the Vietnam War lived 8 months in the bush, mostly in the Northern Territory and Northwest Australia and Queensland, learning from First Nations people various bush tucker and cataloguing them for the military. And so a lot of the information and science work that's gone into that bush tucker went straight into military hands and into like these maps and things so that the military could fight wars up there and soldiers could survive if they got lost. But the hilarious thing about it, it's beautiful footage. And actually, I recommend it to settlers who want to see just how much has been destroyed, because they're like, look at this beautiful bush. Now go back there. I just wanted to make that point that it's like, it goes back, like this relationship of just taking, it goes back, and it even has like military ties, like it's part of the whole system. The food out there and the plants out there and the knowledge out there, it's full of stories, Bush Tucker Man, of explorers and colonizers and the whole lot. He tracks their roots, how they died and how there was food all around them but they didn't know. Or how they got rescued by First Nations people who had a cure for scurvy or something lying in the heart of a palm or something like that and saved their lives. So the whole series is basically following white people doing stupid things in the bush.
I didn't really watch the show, but I was with my partner when they were watching an episode of, what's it called? Lost?
The
reality TV
Survivor
show.
Alone.
And one of the episodes in La Truita, Tasmania, there's a woman talking about being hungry and starving, and you could see the Warrigal greens behind her in the background.
Yeah, that's got a real right-wing appeal, that Alone survivalist shit. Unfortunately, that might mean that they're better in an apocalypse. You did a post about that recently. Matt, I believe people can actually get plants from you if they're interested, and you charge an extremely fair price of like $1 or $2.
Yeah, so if you Unfortunate like us, and you're still on Instagram, we're at Basalt Buddies. And anytime we have a pop-up sales day, we post about it on there. We do have an order form up. We've been a bit busy, so we're probably a bit behind on orders. But yeah, try and sell stuff between $1 and $3, depending on how hard it is to grow. We also have a free plants for mob policy. So yeah, if you're an Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander person, you can send us a message and we'll leave a big tray of plants on your doorstep. And yeah, longer term, we would love to kind of turn it into a project where we're streamlining that process of getting those into your garden, where we got to work out how to, the capitalist side of that. Do we do a Patreon or something that pays for the plants? And then you can just message us, hey, come kill my lawn. That's the dream. But for now, we're just working on our seed bank and growing as much as we can.
Yeah. Oh, cool. Well, that's all we have time for today. So we're going to finish with a song. But thank you, Kieran, and thank you, Matt.
Thank you so much
to talk about. But yeah, I think it was great for the listeners, I hope. And yeah, we're going to fade out now with a song by Joel Hunter Craig called Abolish Australia. Tune in for Think Again up next.
The Gap Report shows that Indigenous men will die 10.6 years less than their non-Indigenous counterparts. I, as an Indigenous woman, have the odds already stacked against me. I'm 9.5 years less life expectancy than my non-Indigenous counterparts.
We do expect it. Australia's not in, you know, it's in a unique observation, peculiarly racist against us. You have why you don't know it now, but we see it. It's Australia itself is uniquely racist against Aboriginal Australians. And I can't put it any more succinctly than that. That's my observations. That's the observations of many Aboriginals here in Australia, and that's how it is. And so it's a long journey for us to undertake. Get used to it.
I don't know how you bridge the gap in child mortality. I don't know how you bridge the gap in terms of Aboriginal people to have a voice. We are the sovereign owners of this country. I am a Wongathat Yamiji Noongar Gidja. We have never ceded sovereignty. I am tired of begging and asking for our humanity. When is it enough? Going on. When you apologize, you do not do it again. The thing is with the stolen generations is that we are still having Aboriginal children forcibly removed from their homes without consultation from their parent or guardian and going straight into the system. Aboriginal people are still denied the basic human rights.
We have enough trouble getting the what I'm going to call the racial virtue signalling right-wing press to call white supremacists terrorists by their proper name.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.